Hello, good evening, and welcome to Health Matters. I am Dr. Randall Brewer, and I will be your host tonight for our continuing update of the COVID-19 pandemic and how it is affecting our area. LSU Health Shreveport has been one of the medical centers on the forefront of tackling this disease through testing and research. And this evening, I am joined by Dr. G.E. Ghali, Chancellor of LSU Health Shreveport, as we talk about these efforts and his thoughts on opening up our state as well as our city. Thank you for joining us tonight, Dr. Ghali.
Thank you, Dr. Brewer.
So, as we were talking before the show sort of got started, you know, life's really turned upside down for a lot of people, this epidemic, even if you have not personally suffered from the illness or your loved ones. Just, you know, reflect on how's this affected you as chancellor of our medical center.
Right. Well, sometimes I wonder, I was telling my wife, Hope, I said, you know, I'm not sure what I did before this virus existed. I must have not worked at all, because it seems like, you know, it's lightened up a little bit in the last, I'd say, couple of weeks. But there was a period for the first month and a half of this virus, Randy, that it was consuming good 18 to 20 hours of each day, you know, trying to figure out what we were going to do with the students, what were we going to do with the residents, what were we going to do with the employees, you know. Some 3,000 or 4,000 employees here on our campus, and and of course our hospital in Monroe, the hospital in Shreveport. What were we going to do to keep everybody safe? We've learned a lot during that period of time, and we know more about the virus and how the virus acts. We don't know everything about the virus. Obviously, we like to be science driven and data driven. Sometimes even with science and data, we don't have all the science and we don't have all the data yet, and we're learning more each and every day. So it's changed it quite a bit. You know, my kids and my wife, for the most part, except for a few times getting in a car and driving around, we literally have not gotten out of the house at all, and obviously no restaurants, no nothing, no church, no school. We have, you know, we're fortunate enough to have somebody shop for us and bring the food home. It's been quite a change for us personally, and again for a lot of the families in Louisiana and around the country. So it's, you know, just like I said before, you know, I've said before, it's sort of like a 9/11 moment. You know, it's going to change. You know, everybody talks about what a new normal is going to be. And, you know, you've known me for a long time, and I'm a little bit older than Randy. And I can remember when I was a kid, you know, if I was going to go fly somewhere, you know, not even a kid, a teenager, even up to the age of 20, go on an airplane, you know, I could decide I wasn't going to go and give my ticket to somebody else and they could fly. Or I could go on the outbound flight and they could come back on the inbound flight and nobody would say anything on the same ticket. So, you know, things have changed. Things changed with 9/11, and we had to start going through metal detectors in the airports and, you know, couldn't carry certain things on and on the plane. And you know, there's no way to control terrorism, you know, and this virus is sort of a way of terrorism, but it's somewhat controllable. We can control it. We have controlled it. I mean, look at what we've done just in the state of Louisiana. We were on a trajectory similar to that of Italy and Spain not more than 30 days ago. And because of all the hard work of everybody, every man, woman, and child in Louisiana, some people could have done better. A lot did really well, and a few did extremely well. But despite the fact that not every single business was closed, and there's hardships, and there's still hardships, but despite that, we were able to bust the curve, and now I believe, certainly in the southern part of the state, they are well on their downward trend. Here in the northern part of the state, I believe we're at the plateau now, and that we're going to begin to see less cases. I really think that unlike a terrorist or the airplane analogy that I was giving, where there's always going to be that threat, and they put up the metal detectors and they say you can't bring this on the plane, that's going to be there forever. But it's not going to be forever that you can't hug your grandmother. It's not going to be forever that you can't shake somebody's hand. It's not going to be forever that we have to stay isolated. It's for a finite period of time. And when we have a vaccine, we will be able to go back to what our normal is. And I believe, as again, you've known me for a long time, I'm a fairly optimistic person. I think that there's going to be a vaccine by the fall. There's too many smart people working on this. And we will find a vaccine. And then when that vaccine happens, then we'll be able to go back to a more normal situation. I hope that certain people have learned from this that, you got to wash your hands after you use the restroom. You got to wash your hands before you eat. I mean, these are things that some people just did not do all in a consistent fashion. Do maybe during flu season, forget the coronavirus, whatever, just regular flu season, it's probably not a good idea to be hugging people and shaking everybody's hands all the time. Maybe that's not necessary certain times of the year. So these are just things that we have to learn.
Sure. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and you're listening to Health Matters here on listener-supported Red River Radio. Our number, if you have a question or a comment for Dr. Ghali, is 1-800-552-8502 or via Twitter at RRR Public Radio. Our guest tonight, Dr. G.E. Ghali, Chancellor of LSU Health here in Shreveport. So, Dr. Ghali, from what I understand, you've been in regular contact with Governor John Bel Edwards with regards to, some of the types of things that, you've already discussed. What are some of the things that he's telling you now in terms of where we are as a state?
Right. Well, I mean, I don't want to get into specifics of what he and I discussed necessarily, Randy, but he is very optimistic about the state. He is optimistic that we're moving in the right direction. He's very thankful for all of the efforts, not just in North Louisiana, but really in all of Louisiana. He was in Washington, D.C. yesterday, as you know, and met with President Trump, got a commitment from Admiral Giroux, who is a Louisiana boy and a very, very smart guy. And he got a commitment to get 200,000 tests a month sent to Louisiana. As you know, the rate limiting factor has been some of the components of the test, whether it's the swabs or whether it's the transport media. Not so much the machines themselves, but mostly the swabs and the transport media. They got a commitment from the White House to send us 200,000 of those units, test units, a month to Louisiana. The governor has a commitment through the Department of Health to do between 150 and 200,000 tests. So I think he was pleased with that. He believes with that commitment that his plan is to reopen the state on the 15th of May. He's going to make a decision on the 11th of May, but I can also tell you that he's committed to continue it beyond the 15th of May if he feels that any activities over the next couple of weeks demonstrate that there is increase in the rate of hospitalizations or in the increased rate of folks getting on the ventilator. Because I think that until we get an adequate treatment, which we don't have, there's some promising things, in some of the clinical trials we're looking at. But until there is a adequate treatment or even better, a vaccine, then I think we're always at risk to get a spike. And so that's something that he's going to continue to monitor, and the smart people at the Department of Health are going to continue to monitor. But he's committed. To answer your question, he has been very responsive to me. He's a responsive guy. He's a great guy. And All indications are that, you know, he told me, he goes, you know, I want to come up in North Louisiana for a visit just for fun. I don't want to have to come up there just when there's a tornado or something, you know, which unfortunately has been the case the last couple of times. He's very concerned about us up here. And so I think he's very happy with the progress that the state is making. But I agree with his decision to keep it the way it is. And all of the experts that I'm talking to in infectious diseases, and the immunologist and the epidemiologist are in complete agreement with the decision that the governor made.
So you mentioned that his extension of the social distancing, you know, and precautions up until May 15th was based on, you know, a curve that looks fairly flat right now from the standpoint of North Louisiana, and then it's going down in South Louisiana. Do you think that up here in North Louisiana we're ready to sort of take those measures and begin to reopen?
Well, you know, I think we are, Randy, but I think that we have to remember the recent data from the Department of Health shows that, you know, in the COVID-like illnesses and the cases in Region 7, which includes Shreveport, you know, Caddo, Bossier Parish, DeSoto Parish, you know, that's kind of Claiborne Parish, and, you know, Mary, those are all in Region 7. They seem to be slightly decreasing, as are the cases. But the hospitalizations seem to be plateauing. Although I will tell you that in our two hospitals here in Shreveport and in Monroe, you know, we've seen about a 20% increase in COVID-related cases. And again, we're not talking about, you know, 1,000 patients. You know, we're talking about, you know, 50 or 60 or 75 patients. So a 20% increase, may represent 12 or 15 patients. But that's significant when you're dealing with those kind of numbers. Of note is that Region 8, you know, Wachita Parish and in those parishes, East Carroll, the in the northeastern part of the state of North Louisiana, their number of cases and their number of hospitalizations are on the increase over the past week. So, and then when also you see that the number of cases in Region 2, which includes Baton Rouge area, East Baton Rouge, West Baton Rouge, in all of Region 2 shows a general increase in the number of cases and an increase in the hospitalizations. So now you've got basically two regions that have plateaus, which are okay, but we want to see it decrease. And one of the plateaus includes up here in Caddo and Bossier Parish. And then you've got a couple of parishes that show an increase. So and it's hard to divide a state up. I agree with the governor. It's hard to divide the state up into counties or into parishes and say, okay, this one can open and that one can't. You almost have to do it statewide. And when you look at it from a statewide, we do not meet the threshold for the gating criteria that's established by the White House Special Committee on Coronavirus Task Force. So you either meet it or you don't. And we don't meet that criteria at this point. I think we will meet that criteria. And I think when we get to have more testing, which with the commitment from the White House is, that we will be able to get more testing out there. Right now, overall in Louisiana, somewhere between 17 to 18% of the tests are positive. So we've gotten probably 160,000 tests done, a little over 28,000 confirmed positives. That's about a 17% positivity rate, you know. And so that is a little more than we like. We would like the positivity rate to be 10% or less. That means that we have a more of a representative random sample. Right now, part of that is because we've been mainly testing symptomatic people. When we start getting out and testing more asymptomatic people, then we'll find that the overall positivity rate goes down. But in the beginning, we didn't have enough tests to test anyone other than symptomatic folks.
Sure. Perhaps Louisiana is similar to what, you know, the country's seeing. New York City has, you know, shown a decrease, and then places like out in the Midwest and Nebraska are starting their, you know, their increase, right? So perhaps Correct. Population centers like New Orleans, they're getting through that phase of the epidemic, and then less populated areas of our state are sort of starting theirs, or maybe, you know, falling behind in terms of getting, you know, getting through that first wave. And which brings up, you know, the next question, which is, you know, what are the people telling you, in particular about our area? You know, if heat is not good for this virus, then we should be sitting pretty down here in Louisiana. What do you think about the summertime, right. you know, disappearance of the virus that's been tossed around? But, you know, countries like Singapore, for example, didn't necessarily see that. So what are folks telling you about the summer?
So I think, you know, I think you got two things going on in the summer. It's clear that viruses, they prefer cold temperatures. You know, you can freeze a virus and it'll stay frozen. And when you thaw it out, it comes back alive again. Otherwise, you can heat up a virus and usually it explodes and, you know, it does not, you know, it doesn't maintain its integrity. So I think you got two things going on when you're talking about the summertime. Yes, it's a little warmer, but it's not like you're boiling these things. There has been some evidence that's come out that talks about ultraviolet radiation from the sun. Sunlight inhibits the viral replication. Okay, that's good. And heat. So that's the summertime. But I think one factor that sometimes comes into play and we may forget about it is in the summertime, we're outdoors more. We're further apart. We're not cooped up in a confined area where, you know, there may be limited ventilation. We're out more, we're riding our bikes, we're jogging, we're going outside, we're in the swimming pool, you know, the chlorine probably kills it. You know, there's all sorts of factors that are going on. So I think all those factors in general mean that flu season in general, coronavirus season, and this virus will probably go down during the summertime. And then as it goes down, people will get more relaxed and more comfortable, you know, but there'll be those asymptomatic individuals that are going to continue to possess this virus and potentially transmit it. So it'll go dormant during the summer, probably will come back in the fall. If I'm a betting man, sometime between August somewhere between mid to late August and October, it'll come back.
You mentioned asymptomatic spreaders. Do we have any idea how many people in our population here in North Louisiana are asymptomatic, you know, spreaders or asymptomatic individuals with the virus? Has any of that work started to take place yet?
You know, we've started on it, but we just don't have adequate numbers yet for me to give you a really good, solid, you know, accurate answer. I would just be guessing. But I will tell you one thing. You know, we recently tested an individual here in Caddo Parish that was completely asymptomatic. Completely. No fever, no cough, no difficulty breathing, no change in his taste or change in smell, no nothing, Randy. We tested him because we decided we would test a group of asymptomatic people. And it takes about five viruses, you know, 5 to 10 viral particles to actually penetrate a cell consistently invade a cell. This individual had over 20 billion with a B viral particles in just the two nasal swabs. You know, we take a little like a Q-tip, we run it down in the nose, one on each side, put it in the transport media, 20 billion. He's got enough virus particles to infect everyone in the United States. And so this is what's scary. So someone like that, unbeknownst to him, he could be working in a nursing home. He could be working in a restaurant or a cafeteria. He could be, God forbid, a healthcare worker. He could infect literally hundreds or thousands of individuals.
So what do we do with people like that? I mean, if you self-quarantine them for 2 weeks and then retest them, chances are they're probably still going to be shedding the virus, correct?
Chances are they're still going to be shedding the virus. You know, we've seen folks for up to 40 days continue to shed the virus. So, you know, I do think that it's important to test them. I think it's important to retest people. I think 2 weeks is a reasonable time to retest, particularly, you know, and of course, if they become symptomatic, then you can retest them earlier. But this is a situation where somebody's positive and then you're going to retest them. So they know that they're positive and we quarantine that individual. I think with the tests that we have in our EVT lab here, our emerging viral threat lab, we have the ability to actually see what the viral load is. And not all labs have that capability. We have that capability. This is not a commercial lab. This is a true research reference lab. And we see somebody that has that high of a viral load, that is not somebody that we want to go back to work. That's somebody that needs to stay sheltered and needs to stay away from other people and just needs to hang out and be retested in a couple of weeks. And is also an individual that we need to get an antibody test on to see, is he producing antibodies to the virus? And that would let us ultimately know when he does reduce the viral load, does he have the ability to fight this virus in the future? And is he an individual that could donate convalescent plasma, which is also a good thing, until we can find a suitable vaccine?
You know, since the immune response is such a big part of the illness, you know, especially in some individuals, right? You wonder if these asymptomatic, you know, shedders actually have much of an immune response. You know, if they're not symptomatic, it'll be interesting to read the final science on this virus once it's figured out.
Yeah, it's a very, very interesting virus, and the whole immune response and the cytokine storm that results with this virus is not like anything that we've ever seen with any other disease process. And that's not just me talking as a chancellor who's not an infectious disease expert, but this is me talking as someone who's in the healthcare field, who has spoken to literally dozens of infectious disease specialists, virologists, and critical care doctors that are actually in the front lines of taking care of these folks. They say that this cytokine storm is just unbelievable. And I will tell you that you wonder about the immune response on some of these. You wonder whether because they have such a strong immune response, and that's why they get this incredible cytokine storm, or is someone who sort of has average immune maybe better than the one that has a great immune response, because that's what this is sort of related to. So it's really an interesting disease process.
You know, some of the talk lately, and I think with people wanting to get out, obviously from the restrictions, that the virus, you know, isn't as bad as we thought it was going to be, is sort of a narrative that's been out there. You know, as the chancellor of the medical school, what would you say to folks who say we grossly overestimated, you know, the potential harm that this virus could do to individuals as well as, you know, to our, you know, our community?
Well, you know, I would say that it's really good that individual didn't have anybody that died in this. But, you know, we've had about 120, I know it says 107 in Caddo Parish, but we've had about 120 folks in Caddo Parish die of this. Not every one of them was an elderly person. Some of them were younger. And so I congratulate that individual for not having anybody in his family die. But if you had somebody that had died or is gravely ill with this disease, then I would say that they would probably say you're crazy. I'll tell you from a from the potential of, I'll just tell you three things. One, the fact that it's so infectious, that it is so easily transmissible from one person to another. You know, 6 feet is a safe distance, but it's probably not safe depending for someone that's got 20 billion particles in him. That's not a safe distance. It is so transmissible that it's really unbelievable compared to the flu. Number two, I would say that unlike the flu, most people that get this are asymptomatic. So it's really, it becomes an enigma or a conundrum of how you're going to adequately follow the patient up, follow their contacts up. Because if you have a disease that, you know, the flu is generally a disease that, you know, everybody gets sick. Who gets the flu, you get the flu, you get sick. And it's not as likely that you're going to have as many asymptomatic carriers with the flu. So with the flu, it's easy to kind of trace, you know, or other disease processes, smallpox, chickenpox, whatever. You can sort of trace your contacts. This becomes difficult because 80% of the people are, for all intents and purposes, are asymptomatic. But that just on the outside, they're asymptomatic. But on the inside, they may have virus in them. And they're the ones that are shedding the virus to the susceptible folks, the elderly, the immunosuppressed, the ones that have significant comorbidities. The third thing I would say is that the cytokine storm, this huge inflammatory mediated response that is occurring in the cardiopulmonary system, is not matched by anything else we've seen in recent times. And that cytokine storm is difficult to manage. And that cytokine storm is causing, in many people, death or at minimum, significant amount of pulmonary fibrosis. And so that's not something we typically see. So I would be careful of saying that this is nothing more than the flu. This would be like saying it's nothing more than getting in a car accident or something like that. It's really two different entities. Yes, they're both caused by a virus, but they are. This is a very, very communicable disease, and I shudder to think what would have happened if we just did not do what we had to do to mitigate some of these factors over the past couple of months.
Let's go ahead and take our first caller of the evening. We have Dr. Friedman from Alexandria. Dr. Friedman, thanks for calling Health Matters tonight.
Hi. You know, we're all trying our best to think of ways that we can help. When I heard you talk about this individual who was carrying billions of viral particles, I got an idea. You know that there's been a drug that just passed tests and shows that it works for the virus. It's hard to pronounce. You might help me with that.
Remdesivir?
That's it. You did a good job on it. So it's a liquid. Has anybody thought of putting it in a nasal spray form?
Yeah, no, we have not put it in a nasal form, but we have given it intravenously to a couple mm-hmm. of patients up here, and you know the result. Again, it's just two patients. It's not many. It's not enough for me to even make a scholarly judgment on it, but. Sounds like an interesting idea, you know, of putting it in a nasal form. I will tell you that the patients that we've given it to have been gravely ill, to where the virus is not just in the nasal cavity, but by the time, and I believe they pretty much all, you know, there's really only five holes that it can get into, right? You know, the two eyeballs, not so likely. The two nostrils, pretty likely, or the mouth, you know. So by the time these folks got to us, the virus had already gotten down into the lower part of their airways. So just putting it nasally wouldn't have been able to be sufficient. But I think early on, and hey, man, if you come up with a, just like we're thinking, or that we've been thinking about using in a clinical trial, inhaled nitric oxide as a prophylactic treatment for healthcare folks, wouldn't be a bad idea to have the remdesivir in a kind of a spray thing, spray it into the healthcare workers' nostrils, and maybe even have it as a mouth gargle with it, swish around, spray it in your nose a couple times, put your N95 mask on, go to work. We're assuming you're working in an area where there's potential COVID patients, and then do the same thing after your shift is over. That's the whole idea with the inhaled nitric oxide as well.
Dr. Friedman, thank you so much for calling Health Matters tonight.
Thank you. Good work. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
We have a caller who submitted their question to our telephone bank. Dennis from Leesville, thank you for your question. Dr. Golly, Dennis would like to know what asymptomatic means.
What asymptomatic means? Well, I mean, it basically is it would be a patient with none of the common symptoms as described by the CDC. Now, the CDC has expanded, you know, potential symptoms, you know, to include things like changes in your ability to smell, changes in your ability to taste. Those are direct result of viral attachment to the nasal mucosa or to the oral mucosa, specifically the tongue and the taste buds. And I'm sure that Dr. Brewer remembers the way that the lingual nerve carries the branches of the facial nerve from the chorda tympani to the tongue to cause the taste to the anterior two-thirds of the tongue, because he's that kind of guy. And the reality is those two symptoms, along with the fever, along with cough, shortness of breath, but also they've included, in addition to the first two that I told you about, the change in, they've also included fatigue, body aches, abdominal aches. These are all now included. And that's, you know, you say, well, God, those aren't real specific. No, they're not. But some of them are subtle things that we don't see in a typical, say, flu. Now, asymptomatic would mean that they don't have any of those symptoms at all, and that they are someone that's coming into your clinic and you're saying, well, you know, for example, the asymptomatic individual didn't have any of those symptoms, but we decide to test them. Right now, as it is, the CDC guidelines, they don't fall into the CDC guideline. But if you're a healthcare worker or you're a susceptible population and you're asymptomatic, then testing may be warranted. That would include someone in a nursing home, and a resident in a nursing home would sort of fall into that category.
This is listener-supported Red River Radio. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. I'm your host tonight on Health Matters. Our guest is Dr. G.E. Golly, Chancellor of LSU Health here in Shreveport. If you have a question about our COVID-19 epidemic, you can call 1-800-552-8502 or tweet at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Golly, you mentioned Louisiana was on a European curve at the beginning of the epidemic. Are there things that we have learned from countries in Europe like Spain and Italy that may be helping us here in the U.S. or in Louisiana specifically in terms of how they've been able to control the epidemic?
Yeah, I think so, Dr. Brewer. I think what we've learned is that early intervention to sort of quarantine folks is probably the best thing you can do, short of having a treatment or having a vaccine. So we learned by looking at some of those countries. And by the way, it's very interesting that you bring that up. And I don't want to digress for just a second. The virus that we have in North Louisiana is very similar to the virus of South Louisiana. And we've done, genetic sequencing on this here at the school. The virus is almost identical to the New Orleans area virus. And it is not identical to the virus of the West Coast. So the virus of the West Coast is very much closer in sequencing to the Chinese virus from Wuhan. The virus in North Louisiana and in South Louisiana is very much, and what reminded me of is when you asked about what we learned in Italy or France, it is very much like the French or the European virus. It is that basic variant of it. And so we know that all coronaviruses tend to mutate quite commonly. This one's mutated probably 4 to 6 times at least, if not more. And the mutation that we have or the variant that we have up here means that either someone from North Louisiana went down to South Louisiana and caught it and brought it up here, or somebody from South Louisiana who got it in South Louisiana came up here for a visit or moved up here, brought it up here, or someone went to Europe on a vacation and came back to the Arklatex and brought it back with them. And then it, or either here or Monroe or whatever, and it spread from there. So I think what we've learned specifically is that early intervention and social mitigation is what worked in those countries, and we followed it very, very carefully, and that it works.
One of the questions that also comes up is that, you know, the death rate can vary from place to place. You know, European death rates were quite high in some areas, as you know. It seems as though our rate of confirmed cases is, I think, 6% here in Louisiana in Caddo Parish in terms of mortality rate. Is that correct? And is that higher than what they're seeing across the country?
Right. If you look at our mortality rate, I think in Louisiana is a little bit higher than it is overall in the nation. That's why if you look at the number, just if you look at today, and again, if you look at the number of new deaths just in the last 24 hours, let alone Louisiana is number 3 in the United States. If you look at deaths per capita, little old Louisiana is still number 5 in deaths per capita. So you're correct. It's about 6.6% the death rate in all of Louisiana. If you look at Caddo Parish, it's about 7%. So we're at or a little bit above the average for the whole state of Louisiana. And the only thing that I can point to that probably is related to that is that as a general rule, the folks in Louisiana are not as healthy as the folks in other parts of the country. I think most surveys you would look at show that. And I think that some of it is genetics, some of it is defined by racial disparities that exist in access to care, which results in comorbidities. So, you know, as I said before, this isn't like cleft lip or cleft palate where, you know, there's, you know, it occurs more often in certain races than others. The virus doesn't care whether you're black or white. It's going to jump on you, okay, and with equal vengeance. But what the difference is that if you have these defined comorbidities, say, for example, you have, hypertension. That seems to be the biggest one that's involved. Diabetes, chronic renal disease, obesity, cardiac disease. Those are really the top 4 or 5. And usually it's not just one of those. It's usually if the individual has hypertension and has diabetes and has renal disease, or they've got diabetes and obesity and some cardiac disease. So it's usually 2 or 3 of those combinations together that have an additive effect that make that individual, whether they're black or white, more susceptible to dying from this virus. But the reality in Louisiana, unfortunately, is the African-American population tends to have a higher incidence of these comorbidities. And because of that, that's the result. And it's unfortunate. And, you know, if you look at the distribution, maybe at best a quarter to a third of the Louisiana population is African-American, but probably close to 2/3 of the deaths from this virus are in the African-American population.
The other question that, you know, that comes up in terms of, you know, mortality from this illness, you know, Dr. Sanford Katz, he was on last week talking about, you know, how he's approaching patient care in this area. You know, patients still get cancer. You still need to, you know, fix cleft lip, cleft palate. You need to do what you do for your patient population. Do you think, number one, you know, we're going to have a persistent effect on our healthcare system in terms of delivering, you know, high quality care to the, you know, to non-COVID illness? And will there be a study of excess mortality? Let's say you've got a baseline mortality rate from cancer, right? Well, for the past 3 months, has that mortality rate changed based upon the COVID nature of our healthcare system as it currently stands?
Yeah. Well, it would be an interesting study. I mean, I certainly hope that we never get that far to have to do that study, because I hope that we have a vaccine and we move on. But certainly there'll be other viral threats in the future. And so we have to be able to manage those. And certainly we don't want to have disease processes like cancer that go untreated for some period of time. Now, in most situations, you know, waiting a month or two doesn't make that much difference in most cases, but it could. And so the idea is, and then that's part of the reason, that's really the major reason why, you know, the governor on the 20th of May declared that beginning on on the 20th of April, when in his executive order, which was an amended executive order, came back and said that on the 27th of April, hospitals in Louisiana can begin doing time-sensitive cases. You could always do emergency cases or urgent cases. But then he said at that point, you know, beginning on Monday, the 27th, this past Monday, you could start doing time-sensitive cases as well. Those are cases like a cancer where you don't want to delay treatment. You know, you want to get the treatment done so the cancer doesn't get larger, doesn't potentially spread. And that's probably the best example is something like that. And so, you know, I think that, you know, unfortunately, there may be a few patients where, you know, their prognosis became a little worse because their surgery got delayed. But I mean, it's sort of this is a pandemic, and, you know, we have to manage things the best we can and manage resources. Our hospitals here, we continue to do, you know, there was a period of about 10 days to 14 days where just about everything shut down except, you know, trauma. You know, we're level one trauma center, trauma and, you know, a bad infection or a gunshot wound or a motor vehicle accident or something. And then there was an occasional cancer that we had to do that we felt needed to be done. But I would say we're pretty much back to normal now doing those type of time sensitive procedures or urgent procedures. But it would be an interesting study, Randy.
From the standpoint of research, you mentioned, you know, nitric oxide. Can you tell us a little bit about what type of research LSU is doing with this virus, with nitric oxide and plasma? And you mentioned some other things going on.
We have about a dozen different clinical trials going on right now related to COVID-19. As you understand, just like we sort of reduced the number of cases, we've reduced the number of so-called non-urgent cases when this virus was at its peak. We also did a lot of other things around the school, you know, making the medical students do remote learning and eliminating clinical rotations for the med students for a while. A lot of that, there was various reasons why we did that we may or may not have time to talk about. But we also eliminated all ongoing research except for research related to COVID-19, so we could focus on that. And so we have about a dozen different trials. We talked about the convalescent plasma, you know, a situation where you know someone develops catches COVID-19, and we treat them and they're positive. And then they go ahead and convalesce or get better, become asymptomatic. We test their serum to see if they have any neutralizing antibodies in there. And, you know, we were one of the first places in the country to provide that particular treatment in conjunction with LifeShare here locally in town. We want to know, are those antibodies actually going to fight the virus? And that's something that's still an ongoing process. Nothing's better than getting a vaccine. Convalescent plasma goes back 100 years in its treatment. But it's something that's valid. And we've used that on several patients here with success. You mentioned the inhaled nitric oxide, and that's, you know, nitric, that's N0, N-O, not nitrous oxide, which is N2O, which the dentist and the anesthesiologist have used for years as laughing gas. But this basically has two activities. Once it's an antihypoxic, so it provides more oxygenation to the lungs, blood supply and oxygenation to the lungs, but it also apparently has a virucidal effect, where on direct contact, it can kill the virus. This has been FDA approved for use at our institution. We've used it on multiple patients with really, really pretty good success. And another drug that we're looking at is the BCG vaccine. The vaccine for tuberculosis, you know, bacillus vaccine. We don't get that real often in the United States. Because we don't have a lot of tuberculosis in the United States. The only time people in the U.S. get it, if they're going to travel to a part of the world and their doc recommends that they get it. But what we found, what we meaning the medical community has found, is that countries that have a high incidence of tuberculosis, that like Africa, India, certain parts of the Indian subcontinent and in parts of Africa, that routinely get the BCG vaccine seem to have some resistance to developing COVID-19. So we have begun an investigator-initiated trial looking at the efficacy of this TB vaccine. Morrison Dixon Company here locally, we're fortunate to have them. They've donated about 5,000 units of this BCG vaccine for us to conduct this clinical trial. We did have a trial on the hydroxychloroquine that the president, proclamates with impunity. And, we know that has limited studies associated with it. There's a study here, a study there. But as recent as about a week ago, the FDA pulled that for outpatient use. And because of its issue with QT prolongation, in of itself, when you combine it with ZPAC, then which also has a propensity for QT elongation, then there was a compounded effect. So for outpatient use, that hydroxychloroquine, which is normally an anti-malarial, it's been around since the mid 1930s, is basically been eliminated now for outpatient use, not recommended for outpatient use. And so we've sort of abandoned that particular trial. There's also a drug called DAS-181 it's a sialidase blocking viral entry, and it's also a very interesting drug. So we have, you know, like I said, about 12 different clinical trials going on, as well as our EVT lab that's up and going, doing some 1,500 or so viral tests a day. We've got the antibody up and running. We've started by this time next week, we'll have our saliva test validated, so we'll no longer need to do nasal swabbing. We're printing out our own nasal swabs with a 3D printer. Dr. Alexander's lab is doing that. So we've got, you know, when I closed down all the other research other than COVID-19, right, and had a huge cohort of really, really smart people, really, really good people, really good, smart people that are working on research.
Sort of your own version of the Defense Production Act, which has been a popular term here lately, it sounds like. Oh, excellent, excellent work, Dr. Ghali. From the standpoint of testing, are people taking advantage of the mobile testing that's available?
Well, they have. You know, the last one we were supposed to do got canceled because that storm rolled in here. But last Saturday we did testing, tested about 200 people out in the Martin Luther King area, David Raines Clinic. We've got times scheduled in some of the areas that have access issues, in particular in the Moortown area, the Oak Park Elementary, at Woodlawn High School in the Cedar Grove area, and we have the David Raines in Bossier, as well as we're going to go up to Gillum, up in North Caddo, and in Marion and Bastrop and Minden and Haynesville. These are all areas, as well as areas in the Northeast. We're hitting areas over there as well. We were very, very fortunate to get a grant from the Caddo Commission to help us out with this, because we're not charging anything for these tests. And so we're just doing as many as we can to get a representative sample.
Hey, a caller sends in a question, and you mentioned the virtual learning that's going on in the School of Allied Health as well as in the medical school.
Correct.
This mother is concerned about sending her kids back to school in the fall, and you mentioned, I think you said if you had to put money down, you would expect there to be a second wave in mid-August through up to October. How would you explain to parents the risk stratification that's going to happen in terms of, you know, getting large groups back together? Obviously, there's going to be a lot of parents ready to get their kids back to school in the fall.
Right. Well, you know, LSU is on the main campus in Baton Rouge. They're basically going to do distant learning until the fall. They're not going to go back until the fall. And you know, that's going to be difficult, obviously, for some of the public schools around here. So I think it's something we just have to look at. I like I said, I'm optimistic that there's going to be a vaccine, but I do think that there will also be some degree of herd immunity that's going to occur within the population, whereby some of these asymptomatic folks will develop some immunity, which will help prevent the virus from spreading. And again, we still don't know how much immunity will develop with that, but there will be some that develops, and there'll be a lot of that will be in the younger population as well, that are going to be in the school-aged population. I think for the most part, there a lot of the children that are running around probably had it, have it, and they're doing well. I expect them to continue to do well, and many of them to have developed immunity to it. I don't know if a vaccine will be available before school starts again, although I'm optimistic that sometime in the fall there'll be a vaccine. My recommendation for those schools are, it's really difficult to take a preschooler or a first grader or a second grader and say you need to physically distance yourself, because that ain't gonna happen, but it's a little bit easier in the older elementary school and the middle school, and certainly in high school as well. But there may be a situation where they have to wear masks, where there has to be Purell in every classroom. They have to wash their hands, or they have to use some of the hand sanitizer on a routine basis before they go to the bathroom, when they come back from the bathroom, for lunch. Desks need to be put further apart, and most importantly, their temperature needs to be checked when they come in the morning to school. If they've got a temperature, then they probably won't be allowed to come in. Again, a lot of this I'm just talking off the top of my head right now, because none of this has been really completely defined yet, but will need to be defined as time goes on and as we test more people over the next couple of months.
From the standpoint of testing, both LSU employees as well as regular employers, as we start to open up again, what are your feelings about routine testing for people who have not had the virus, as well as your stance on serology testing?
Yeah, so I mean, certainly anybody that's symptomatic needs to be tested, and then people that are asymptomatic, certainly we're going to have to get a random, sort of a representative random sample of the population to know exactly what the incidence of this is. I think that, again, the asymptomatic individuals that are high risk, they all need to be tested. And high risk for my employees here at the Health Science Center are going to be all the clinical faculty, all the students, now maybe the students that are in the first and second year, maybe not so much right now. Maybe we can hold off on them. Those are the ones that are going to continue remote learning. I'm not even going to consider bringing those back on campus until the governor releases the stay-at-home order. And even then, when he releases it, guys, there's going to be some restriction into size. I can't have a room with 200 students in it. It ain't going to work. You know, they're going to have to be sitting several chairs apart. So there may be a lot of reason to continue the remote learning through the fall in the hopes that this vaccine comes around. Then we won't have to worry about this like we do now. But those high-risk groups are the ones we're going to test. And what we're going to do is we're going to do testing. We started this last week, and it's going on last week and this week because the students start back tomorrow on their clinical rotations. So they're going to get their testing done, viral testing done every 2 weeks. And they're going to get a baseline serology done to check for antibodies. And then if they end up being positive or they become symptomatic, we're going to test them before 2 weeks. If sometime during the every 2 week test, their test becomes positive, the CDC guidelines for us say that we send them home and quarantine them for 10 days. We bring them back, retest them, whether they're positive or not. We can, as long as they're asymptomatic at that point, they can put on an N95 mask and they can work. And when their test reverts to negative, then they can just wear a regular surgical mask, not an N95 mask.
From the standpoint of the antibodies test, you know, where are we with that? I understand you're offering the test to LSU mm-hmm. faculty and staff.
Correct. We're doing that test, but we are in the process. It's an identical test it was developed in conjunction with the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, and probably our test will be one of the first 10 tests that are approved in the United States for this. So what we've applied for is an FDA EUA. An EUA is an emergency use authorization, and we're hoping that EUA comes in any day. I expected it Monday, so I've been asking Dr. Kevel on a daily basis, has the EUA come in yet? And so once we get it, we will be testing, you know, all positive individuals with that test. Of course, we'll also be testing healthcare workers that are asymptomatic, at least to get a baseline on them as well. The importance of getting the antibody test is, particularly for the essential workers, is that it allows us to know they've got antibodies. And our particular antibody test is very, very sensitive. So it will allow us to know actually qualitatively how well those antibodies are working as well, so we can get those folks back to work with some assurance that they've got some immunity to this disease, and it doesn't waste as much PPE, and there's a whole lot of reasons why that's beneficial.
Speaking of PPE, are the PPE that we have now currently adequate for the demand as well as ventilators? Well,
It is adequate, Randy, but you and I, I'm used to using a mask one time and throwing it away. And every time I leave the operating room, I throw the mask away and I put on a new mask when I come in. That's the way we are. But the reality is there's not enough PPE right now to be able to do that. It doesn't mean if the mask is soiled, you need to throw it away. But typically most hospitals around the country now are making you reuse your mask. And are you looking at techniques to re-sterilize masks? That's not a normality. So in the sense of, do we have enough to manage things? Yes. Could it be better? Yes.
Dr. Ghali, thank you so much. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have, but we'll definitely invite you back. And again, we really appreciate your participation with our program tonight.
Hey, thank you, Dr. Brewer. God bless you guys.
Thank you so much. You can find more information on COVID-19 at coronavirus.gov. This program will be available for podcast at www.redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Thanks tonight to Mr. Kermit Poling as well as Mr. Wally Derleth for providing assistance this evening. Views and opinions expressed on Health Matters may not reflect those of the station, LSUS, or its staff. Health Matters has been made possible in part by the Noel Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you so much for joining us this evening. Tune in next Thursday as we continue our special Health Matters coverage. This is 89.9 FM KDAQ Shreveport-Bossier, 90.7 KLSA Alexandria Pineville, 90.9 FM KBSA El Dorado Camden Magnolia, 88.9 FM KLDN Lufkin Nacogdoches, and 100.7 FM KTYK Overton Tyler Kilgore. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Don't have a friend who feels at ease.